Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the World of Sharks podcast, a podcast all about sharks, rays and their underwater habitat, brought to you by the Save Our Seas Foundation. I'm Isla, a scientist and science communicator for the Save Our Seas Foundation, and every episode I have the absolute pleasure of getting to sit down with experts in shark science, conservation, education and storytelling to take you on a deep dive into a different part of the wonderful world of sharks. This week we are diving into the complicated but very interesting world of international relations and policy making to better understand protections for sharks at a global level. In November 2022, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Flora and Fauna, or CITES for short, made history when its members voted to add the entire family of requiem sharks and small hammerhead sharks to Appendix 2, effectively bringing 90% of the international fin trade under regulation. Now, some of you might be sitting there thinking, Isla, what on earth are you talking about? And don't worry, we'll be breaking it all down in this episode. What CITES is, how it works, how international treaties work, and what I mean by Appendix 2, all of that. But in short, it was a monumental moment for shark and ray conservation. The international fin trade is not only one of the leading drivers behind the decline in global shark populations, but it is also a very lucrative industry, generating millions of dollars annually. This means that many nations around the world have a vested interest in seeing it continue, and that makes passing any international law or policies to regulate it extremely difficult. But it did happen, and in this episode, we'll be finding out why. And to help us navigate this very challenging and convoluted territory, I am very glad to say that our guest today is Luke Warwick, who, luckily for us, has over 20 years of experience in marine conservation policy, including at the intergovernmental level. Luke began working on shark management and policy in 2006, helping to shape the programs of work that established the first listings of commercially exploited sharks and rays under CITES, and their implementation in priority countries. Since then, Luke has collaborated with many others to list more sharks and rays under the convention, culminating in that landmark vote in 2022. He is now director of the Sharks and Rays Programme for the Wildlife Conservation Society, leading over 10 projects in shark conservation hotspots around the world, from Argentina to Gabon, India and Indonesia. It's safe to say that Luke knows a lot about CITES, international treaties, and their relevance to sharks. In this episode, he walks us through what CITES is, how it works, and the history of sharks and rays on CITES. We also discuss what's happened in the year since that historic vote, because a lot of work has been done to help countries implement the new listings, and there has also been some important progress made towards tackling the shark fin trade and protecting shark and rays globally. We also talk about some of the challenges of working at this level and trying to get things across the line. It's definitely not easy, but we also talk about why CITES is particularly effective at doing that. This is a super informative episode packed full of useful information, and Luke is so good at explaining it in a way that is easily digestible and also fun to listen to. As always, we will leave links in the show notes as to how you can find out more about Luke and his work for the Wildlife Conservation Society, so please do go and check them out. But for now, make sure that you have some snacks, a nice beverage, and let's dive into our episode. Hello, Luke, and welcome to the World of Sharks podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
We're so delighted to have you and have you walk us through something quite large and complicated, and we're very grateful that you're able to do that for us, and a very important topic as well, especially as we've talked about CITES on this podcast before, but I wanted to sort of revisit it again, especially as it's been a year since that landmark moment for sharks. And we will get into that in a little bit. But before we do that, we are going to find out a little bit more about you. And we like to start and end the podcast with the same question for every guest. And the first one is, do you have an experience with the ocean or marine life that stands out for you as particularly memorable or special?
So I think two, really. I grew up on the Gower Coast in South Wales, and as a child spent a lot of my time rock pooling in that area. It's a hard area to live in and not fall in love with the ocean. I really grew up wanting to spend my time safeguarding the marine environment. I mean, it's very clear if you look at the sort of the big oil spill that was in that area when I was growing up and overfishing, just to feel the impacts that we're seeing on the oceans in real time. But then, I mean, that's one, but obviously it's not the most spectacular of marine life, even if it is very interesting. But the first time I really got to snorkel with whale sharks was really a mind-blowing experience. Seeing the scale of those and visiting countries in the global tropics for the first time and just seeing the range of marine biodiversity there on coral reefs and species like whale sharks and manta rays really showed me how much there is still in the world that we can preserve if we act in time to save it. So I'd say that was really the two experiences that have shaped my interest in conserving the world's oceans.
Sure. I've always wanted to get down to Wales and explore the coastline a little bit. It does look beautiful.
I think it is. I think what we can look at in some sort of early onset industrial countries such as the UK, though, is how much we've lost and really the issues of shifting baselines and us not really as humanity being able to remember what we had. If you look back at the historical records of the sharks and rays or indeed cetaceans we had around the coast in the UK, a lot of the work I do now is in the countries that still have those assemblages of animals with time left to protect them from the mistakes that we've made. So it is really, it's both a challenging and a fascinating time for these type of issues. And we're in kind of a narrow window of whether we can safeguard some of these species, especially the world's most vulnerable marine animals, such as sharks and rays.
Sure. And we're going to come on to, obviously, we're going to spend most of this episode talking about CITES, which is just one of the tools in the toolkit that we can use. But I was interested to know when sharks came into your life. So were they something that you were always fascinated by? I know you said you grew up rock pooling and, you know, jumping in the cold water of Wales. But when did sharks kind of first appear?
So my relationship with sharks is actually kind of an interesting one. I think most of the time when you speak to people in this field, they'll tell you that this their passion from a very young age. They loved sharks so much. They were the marine animals that made them want to go and work on marine conservation issues. It's not really the case for me. And it's maybe because my pathway to working on these issues is slightly different to others. I don't have a master's or even a PhD in these issues. I started working on this issue from a policy perspective, actually working for the government in the UK. And then from there have worked now in a range of charities trying to advocate for marine conservation issues. So really I've been involved in the kind of boring, more pragmatic side of how do you design effective laws that are going to safeguard some of these animals now. I have a very strong personal interest in the oceans and conserving them, as I mentioned. But really, for me, it's the oceans in general. I didn't really have a particular species or an issue that I was more excited on than anything else. But I kind of got landed with sharks very early on in my career when I very first started that work, you know, almost 20 years ago, because it was around the time where people were aware there was a problem. You know, shark finning was in the news. People were worried about the survival of the species. People were first starting to recognize sharks and rays maybe as not something to fear, sort of post-Jaws era, maybe something more that is a conservation issue. You know, people were very well aware by then, you know, whales, dolphins, turtles, even some fish stocks, bad condition, need to be repaired. But sharks and rays were just coming on the radar. And every time I moved on to another big major ocean conservation issue, I'd find myself back working on sharks and rays, mainly because, you know, I had a background knowledge on the issue, but also just because it was growing in terms of people's awareness of it and the need to act. So really, it's an issue that's kind of stuck with me. And then, you know, over the last 10 years, it's taken up all of my time just because we're in that kind of critical window of, is there something we can do to stop large body sharks and rays going extinct around the world? And we, you know, we basically have a couple of decades to do that. We've just seen examples now in the scientific literature of the first extinctions of marine species, and it's a ray. So, I mean, that's not going to be the last on our current trajectory. So what can we do about that?
Yeah, for sure. And it definitely seems like this last decade, I mean, people first became aware, as you say, of the plight of sharks and rays about 20 years ago. But it definitely feels like even since 2010 was when, kind of when I started uni, and no one was really talking about sharks when we talked about ocean conservation. And if you look at that from to where we are now, which is like sharks kind of really have captured people's imaginations, and a lot of people are very aware where they went before. And then there's all of this momentum, like you said, it's quite a challenging time, but also quite an exciting time.
I think shark scientists and then educators working with them have done a fantastic job over the last 20 years. As someone who approaches this kind of from initially a government and now working with governments on how you develop effective conservation policies perspective, those sort of groups like governments are never going to act if the general public and or scientific literature doesn't care and doesn't present a picture of why you need to do stuff and what you need to do. And I think really over the last two decades, we've managed to generate a lot of political momentum, but that's because of the wealth of leading shark scientists working out ways that they can get the message across that we're going to lose these species unless we change the way we interact with them. For highly migratory, especially shark species, it's so hard to document some of these declines. You have to really dig through stuff. It's very sophisticated, well-developed science to kind of pull stuff together and say, look, you may not see this day to day, but this is because this has been lost over the first 40 years of industrial fishing, which you didn't document properly. And just really an eye-opener, I think, for almost everyone is every time I do an introductory presentation on sharks for policymakers, one of the first things we show people is a comparative table. And it shows sharks and rays, and it uses examples such as, you know, dusky shark or a manta ray, and their reproductive rates. And it compares them to iconic land animals like a tiger or an elephant, and then some other fish species such as a tuna or a mahi-mahi. And just shows that sharks and rays effectively are the same as those land animals. You know, the fish spawning and having, you know, millions of eggs twice a year, and, you know, sharks and rays just not being like bony fish effectively. And it's kind of a compelling message because it really does show to people who maybe haven't considered sharks or rays before that if you manage them like you're managing bony fish, they're just going to be fished out. And we know that, and we have all the examples now. But the big challenge, even with the progress in the last two decades, has been how do we make that happen quicker? Because the current speed of progress isn't going to be fast enough, which takes us to some of the issues like CITES, like other international treaties, about how can we get a driver around the world that really incentivizes countries to act faster and protect these species before it's too late.
Yeah, it's hugely challenging, hugely complicated. And I think we'll kind of come onto this a little bit later on as well. But just the amount of time these things take to develop and get passed, and then the implementation that comes after that. These are all things we're kind of going to go into using kind of CITES as an example, but you can apply that to a lot of other different or very similar kind of international treaties as well. But before we get into that, you are now the director of the Shark and Ray Program at the Wildlife Conservation Society. Can you explain what the WCS does and what your kind of role is within that?
Yes, I can. So the Wildlife Conservation Society, or WCS, is headquartered out of the Bronx Zoo in New York, but really the big focus of our work is on conservation is via our country programs. You know, we're working in over 40 countries around the world, mainly focused in the global tropics. And of those, for about 15, we work specifically on shark and ray conservation. And then over 20, we're doing wider marine conservation. Like most large conservation organizations, that started with a focus on terrestrial conservation, on large forests and some of the more intact ones around the world. And then over the last two, three decades, that's moved very much into being working on those terrestrial issues, but also marine conservation, as we around the world have become aware of that the ocean is not limitless, as we may previously have thought, that actually we need to do a lot if we're going to safeguard it. And you know, what we do in those country programs are, you know, they're linked to the big organization as a whole, but they're also pretty independent in shaping what are the conservation strategies and approaches needed in that country, because, you know, the vast majority of the staff in those locations are from the places where they're working or the region. And that allows us to do work normally in close partnership with, you know, local or grassroots NGOs in those countries to be a long-term presence there and work out how are we going to effectively and equitably develop conservation measures. And when we drill down to the level of sharks and rays, yeah, a lot of that is we collect a lot of data on artisanal fisheries. We spend a lot of time in kind of more isolated coastal communities working out, you know, what's happening to coral reefs, what's happening to shark and ray populations, how are small-scale fisheries developing and how are people dependent on those, and how can marine protected areas and management of fisheries and species work in these areas, trying to really develop, you know, kind of holistic programs of marine conservation. So it's working at the local level, but also as WCS, we also work at the multilateral level, going to meetings such as, you know, CITES or the Convention on Migratory Species and others, and seeing if we can develop measures there which can help in that mission of progressing conservation more rapidly and equitably at the local level.
So now, Ken, you mentioned CITES there. And for people who have never heard of CITES, so I know you mentioned there it's a multilateral agreement, but for someone who has never heard about that, can you explain what it is and how it works?
I certainly can. And my first plug would be that it's not as boring as it sounds. So the Convention on the International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora, or CITES, has been around for around 50 years. And if you haven't heard of it, you probably have, because if you see issues around the ivory trade and the fact that there are still elephants in Africa, then you've heard about CITES, because the free-form trade in animal products around the world, if you think back to whaling and ivory industry times, was systematically stripping out biodiversity around the world. CITES was developed to stop that. The aim of the convention is to either prohibit or regulate international trade in products that wouldn't be sustainable to stop extinctions of wild animals and plants, if you drill it down to its simplest level. It has two appendices, which is, you know, kind of lists of species effectively. You've got Appendix 1, which is a de facto trade ban. It basically says unless the reason is non-commercial, you shouldn't be trading this species. So species like elephants on that list, the great whales are on that list. And then you've got Appendix 2, which is where it gets a little more complicated. Appendix 2 says you can't trade the species unless you can demonstrate the trade is sustainable via a scientific assessment and a permitting process that traces the point at which you have extracted that species from the wild through to the point of use at the other end through international trade. And really, that's kind of what it boils down to. And the reason that it probably has been more effective is a lot of the international treaties that came after it have strong text, but very limited compliance action and ability. The reason that people gravitate around CITES is because it is quite effective in having formal compliance action through its structure on the countries that don't comply, because CITES is a range of strong measures which basically encourages and then forces countries to do that if they want to continue trading other species. And you have over 30,000 species listed on CITES, and the vast majority of those are listed on CITES Appendix 2. That's a lot of money being traded, you know, every year, a lot of benefit to a range of people around the world from all of these animals and plants. And that creates a driver, because countries don't want to be prohibited from trading, let's say, orchids or captive bred frogs and lizards, all of the hardwood products. So they have an incentive to try and manage all the species listed on in their country.
We're going to get into the history of sharks and rays on CITES next, but I just wanted to rewind a little bit very quickly. We mentioned COPs there, we mentioned countries who are involved, and I just wanted to make sure that we break it down, because I'm aware that it can be quite confusing, because a lot of people, when they hear the word COP, they'll associate that with climate change, the International Panel on Climate Change, because that's where we hear about it a lot. You'll hear about there's a COP going on in a certain country, but all COP means is Conference of the Parties, and the parties are referring to the governments or the world leaders or the countries who have signed up to this international treaty, right?
Yeah, and I think the level of attention around the climate COP is incredible, and obviously a great thing to see compared to where we were only a decade away. Yeah. But I mean, sometimes we lose our focus on biodiversity while we're talking about climate. These two things should be obviously be dealt with together, but the intricacies of how we've developed international policy means that they have been separated out. And again, you have things like the Convention on Biological Diversity separate to something like CITES. So these are spread out over a range of issues. And because of the media attention around climate change these days, which is fantastic to see, cop has kind of become synonym for the action of that body, whereas actually this is, I mean, this is a general process, United Nations, another body term, where, yeah, you're talking about the form through which these conventions make their decisions, effectively. So almost every big international convention has to have a forum where it almost forms like a mini parliament for the individual countries to debate together what they should do. And CITES, another thing that makes CITES quite effective, is unlike most other international bodies, you know, the Climate COP's a good example here, these are all bodies that tend to make their decisions via consensus. Incredibly hard to reach consensus on some of these controversial issues, hence these bodies being tied up in very slow processes that don't really deliver the level of ambition you want. CITES does not. I mean, it sets out to do that, but then has a very well-developed and well-used voting mechanism. And so for things like adding a species to one of those two lists, it requires a two-thirds majority of the countries that are attending that Conference of the Parties. So, I mean, that means that you're never going to get every country to agree, but on something that has a really strong scientific base and political momentum, there's actually a good chance of getting two-thirds of the countries to agree, even if some of them have, let's say, a vested financial interest in that species, or just a political reason why they don't want to support it. So it's another reason why CITES has been able to take action quickly enough to save species from extinction. I feel like if it didn't have those voting mechanisms, it probably wouldn't have done so.
Yeah, and we're talking about, when we talk about CITES, I believe it's like something like 184 countries are signed up now.
Yeah.
Which is a huge number of, you know, different interests, different backgrounds, different cultures, all of that kind of thing. So it's very difficult to, it would be very, very difficult to reach consensus, as you said. And that brings us on really nicely to sharks, because that's the exact reason why CITES can be a very powerful tool for shark conservation, is because shark products are traded all around the world. You know, it's a global trade with lots and lots of different countries having a stake in the trade. And also, we know that overfishing, while not the only threat, is the primary threat to this group of animals. So regulating trade in shark products is hugely important. And we're going to kind of talk about that as we get further into the episode. But first, I wanted to sort of delve a little bit into the history of sharks and rays on CITES, because I know that it wasn't until relatively recently that sharks and rays first appeared, right?
Historically, marine species hadn't really been considered under CITES as a priority. I mentioned it before, but great whales had been listed, and then really CITES, for a range of political reasons, had steered away from dealing with fish. That's dealt with separately by fisheries bodies, international fisheries bodies. We shouldn't be touching that. But over the last two decades, there's been a big change. And it's mainly come via the listing of a wide range of shark and ray species, with the aim of those listings to create that driver and kind of rely on CITES' effectiveness at driving better management because of the pressure of all these other species listed.
I've seen mixed, so I wonder if you can sort this out for me. I've seen mixed answers to this on which was the first species that was added to CITES, because I used to think it was the great white, but then you've also got the whale shark and the Baskin shark all kind of went up at similar times.
It's a very good question. I believe you're correct, though. I believe it was the great white and then the other two followed. But those were all listed between two COPs quite early on in the process. You're going back 20 years now to when those species were adopted. As we said before, CITES makes decisions via votes and had very much focused on terrestrial species and was just starting to move into more challenging terrestrial issues like orchids and hardwoods that it hadn't considered before. Because it mainly, even within the terrestrial, it had dealt with like the iconic animals, you know, the tigers, the lions, the rhinos and elephants, great white shark, and some of those iconic big shark species that weren't really thought of and weren't really exploited at that stage as much. So great white shark, whale shark, Baskin shark. It was already kind of accepted that they were kind of marine wildlife, but they weren't associated with the other sharks, that it was still being caught in these huge quantities. And so it was around the time we really started to understand better about the shark fin trade, and that fin trade was made up of around 100 species, and that trade was driving these huge declines in coastal and high seas fisheries around the world. So at that time, a lot of countries had brought these proposals to CITES and said, well, CITES should really be looking at sharks too. This is a huge issue. It really should be considered. And for the 10 years that followed that, those species weren't listed. And, you know, that in reality is because a subset of countries, mainly led by countries from East Asia, blocked those proposals. They were able to get, you know, if you need 2/3 to adopt it, if you can get just over 1/3, you can block it. And they were successful. So after those big species were listed, you had a decade of very little progress. Swordfish were then added to Appendix 1, actually. It's still the only charts raised on Appendix 1. But, you know, sadly, that's because, you know, the science was gathered and published that basically showed that being extirpated from most of their range. But for any species that was traded in major quantities, those countries were successful in blocking it till you get up to 2013, which was the real landmark moment where the first commercially traded charts and rays were adopted onto CITES at a COP that took place in Bangkok. And at that one, at CITES COP 16, you had species like the oceanic whitetip, the three large-bodied hammerheads, including, you know, scallop smooth and great hammerhead, and the poor beagle shark, and both species of manta ray were listed. Even though those were species that had already declined so much that probably sustainable trade wasn't going to be possible, and they were listed onto Appendix 2, which is the one that deals with sustainable trade, it was hugely politically significant because it was an admission that CITES, by adopting those, which passed by 1-2 vote margins, so tiny margins that were almost overturned in the last session of the meeting, it was CITES taking a strong role on saying, we're going to try and regulate the shark fin trade, even though those species together made up around 10% of that fin trade. So of the 100 or so species, those ones made up about 10%. So important, but, you know, really incremental. And then over the COPs that followed, 3 years and 6 years after that, additional species were listed, such as thresher sharks, silky sharks, the rest of the mobulid rays, wedgefish. And again, these species very, very strongly justified their listing, and it showed that CITES was becoming more comfortable with adopting shark listings and then trying to regulate the trade after that. So we jumped up during that time period to about 25% of the shark fin trade regulated, around 46 species listed, which is great. Again, incremental progress. And we're starting to see some really good examples of how that was being implemented and in some cases how it was protecting species or reducing mortality around the world. So really encouraging.
Yeah. And then since then, we've had quite a lot of momentum gathering, right? And that leads us up until November 2022, so over a year ago now, where a landmark vote was made to list requiem and hammerhead sharks on Appendix 2. And this was huge. And I remember, like, all of the Save Our Seas team, we were all WhatsApping each other and watching this kind of, for me, it was the dead of night, trying to figure out which way it was going to sway. And it was such a kind of controversial proposal in the first place.
Yes, at COP19, at that one you mentioned last year, as you said, a very controversial proposal, which proposed via listing all requiem sharks and all the smaller bodied hammerheads to jump overnight from 25% of the shark fin trade regulated under CITES to 90% plus, most likely over 95%, in fact, going from those 46 species to now over 140 species listed of sharks and rays listed on CITES. And we live in an era where this is the sort of change we need to see happen in the world, but we don't get that many examples of it, to be honest. It's not been a great time for that politically around the world. So when this was up for debate, as you said, it was highly controversial on the floor. A lot of countries really battled for and against it. The thing I always think, you go to some international meetings and stuff passes really easily by consensus. To me, that probably tells me that, is it actually a worthwhile measure? If you're at a meeting and you have governments making any amendment they can to a proposal, trying any excuse they can find, trying to rebut peer-reviewed science published in Nature and Science, then you know that it's probably a measure they don't want to see because it's going to be effective and it's going to affect their bottom line. And that probably means it's a strong conservation measure. The proposal was adopted, and as of November, because it had a one-year delay, 95% plus of the shark fin trade is now listed on CITES. So if you trade a shark fin, if someone sees a shark fin, that has to have a CITES permit almost certainly. And if it doesn't, it's illegal and should be dealt with like other illegal wildlife products, like you would a rhino horn or anything else you might find.
Which is, it's incredible. It's absolutely incredible. And I know there's a lot of hard work still to do with the implementation, but just for our listeners just to sit and think about that, that went from 25% to over 90% of the fin trade coming under regulation in sort of one sitting, really. And it passed through quite quickly, weirdly enough. So there were a few amendments that were proposed they didn't get through. And the funny thing was is that the whole of the Save Our Seas team were messaging each other. And like I said, kind of, I was watching it like a little gremlin in my living room at ungodly hours of the morning. Because they did it as an anonymous vote. So rather than people kind of raising their hands and saying, yes, I vote for this, they kind of did it on some sort of online wizardry so that the votes went up through. But it flashed up on the screen very, very briefly for like a split second. I don't know if you remember this.
People that I work with refer to that as the screen of doom. So at CITES, you can spend, you know, let's say 2 decades of your life working towards something. And then the systems these days are online. So every government has a little card they put in a slot, they push a button. And then, yeah, a lot of controversial things where there's a lot of debate. The country quite often at CITES asks for something to be decided by secret ballot. So effectively, normally, yeah, you see each country just pop up on the screen saying yes, no, or abstain. But on these secret ballots, you don't see anything. You just see like a loading wheel. You wait and then the results pop up. So there's nothing quite like having the culmination of a lot of work and things you've sacrificed professionally and personally for come down to a loading wheel and then something on a big screen. But I think the key thing there is for a subset of people around the world, people that work in some of the governments who are proposing that, because you had a wide range of governments joining it, tens of governments putting their name on it and their teams working on it. All of the shark scientists who pulled together the information on the fin trade and the declines of these species, and all of the advocates around the world who work in nonprofits who help support that and work out, you know, how do we help get the science to those governments so they can see if this is something they want to progress. There are many people around the world who spent so much of their time and sacrificed so much to try and set that up, because really it was a decade of work from that meeting in Bangkok where you had the first commercial species considered for CITES through to that meeting where you regulate the entire fin trade. That happened because a lot of people did an incredible amount of work of how do you translate science into policy, work at an international fora and keep momentum going, because we had to also help governments and other bodies implement the listing so that you could show during that time period it was worth doing more. Not just, a lot of people just wanted to list those first ones in 2013 and be like, okay, that was hard, we're done, let's see if we can implement those and make it perfect and then maybe revisit it. Yeah. But if you've got species as vulnerable as sharks, as we discussed before, being utilized in the way they are around the world, regulating a small subset of the trade just isn't going to cut the mustard. You know needs this level of ambition, and then, as you said, that doesn't mean the job is done. The job enters a phase that a lot of us are very engaged in now, which is how do we turn that into less dead sharks. But at least now we have a strong driver with compliance action that can help us get there. Mm-hmm.
And that it was wonderful to watch as well. And you just knew how much work had gone into that. And now we have a lot of other hard work to do, and that has been done in the year since. And I was wondering if you could just tell our listeners, what has happened since that vote was passed?
It's one of those strange ones, right? So very happy this has passed. Everyone can have a little celebration, but then sadly, get back to the real work. And there's been a lot of different workshops, strategy meetings and development of tools and stuff over the last year. It's kind of in two parts. One is, what tools do government need to implement that? So as I said before, you're now in a situation where you've got continued trade in shark marine products around the world. And for shark fins specifically, almost certainly going to need CITES paperwork, which means you need to know what's being caught at landing site level. You need to trace that and you need to be able to identify it, so customs staff can be looking through and being like, oh, shark fins, I should be inspecting that. Is there paperwork? Should I confiscate it? Before that even happens, how do you assess fisheries to say, well, this might be sustainable and we could continue fisheries here? Or when might you need to prohibit the retention of those species and work out ways to release them alive? So we've worked and partnered with a range of scientists and other groups to develop identification guides to all the listed species, updated for all these newly listed ones, refinements to a tool that develops something called non-detriment findings, which is basically a CITES term for scientific assessments that show you might be able to continue trade, or indeed might tell you, no, you need to protect that species, that needs to go on your protected species lists. So we developed all those tools and even genetic testing machines that can be used to verify if a species of CITES listed, if there's going to be, you know, court and prosecution action. And all of those tools tell you something, because this just depends on how you think about it. the problem for sharks is overfishing and trade, but actually that's not the problem. If I think about it in my way of like a policymaker, the problem is no management of the fisheries or no protection of the species. And that's basically what we've seen for decades since the onset of industrial level fishing for sharks and rays. But now this kind of CITES listing and the compliance of it are making it so that's no longer possible for governments. And we're already seeing that actually at the CITES compliance committee. So between the COPs, CITES holds two kind of compliance meetings, which are kind of like mini COPs. So most of the governments show up, and that's where CITES has its teeth and looks at, is stuff being effective? And this year already, they've identified a range of countries, over 10 countries, for some of the species that were listed earlier. So the large hammerheads, oceanic whitetip, manta ray, saying, oh, actually, we don't think this is good. I mean, we're seeing large levels of trade. It's not sustainable. And now over the next 2 years, there's this formal compliance action that runs through those committees, which can lead to those countries being prohibited from trading sharks and rays or any CITES listed species. So along with providing all these tools and the momentum to try and help countries generate the policies they need and then implement them, there's also this multilateral enforcement level, which is what gives CITES its effectiveness, now acting to push even more pressure on it. And we're going to see that expand out to all of these other traded species over the coming decade, which is, I mean, that's hard. We want to see, it would be much better if people were just going to, out of the goodness of their heart, go and manage this and comply with the rules. Sadly, we know that's probably not the case. So we are going to see a lot of this. But again, now there is a forum through which to feed in all the science that's developed, all of the sad stuff about looking at when we've got species on the edge and we're going to lose them, that will result in better compliance and conservation action. So the hard stuff is to come, but also kind of the good stuff is to come. I think this really will result in better management of shark and ray fisheries. And indeed, we're seeing examples of that already, where countries are acting on the basis of these listings and either managing or protecting sharks and rays.
It would be a lovely world if everybody complied with rules just out of the goodness of their hearts.
Exactly right.
But I guess that's one of the trickiest things, and one of the reasons why the proposal to add requiem sharks in particular. So we kind of didn't touch on this, but requiem sharks are a family of sharks that includes something like 56 species. And when you're talking about the fin trade, a lot of those fins, a lot of the body parts look pretty similar to one another. They're quite difficult to identify just based on sight alone. So that's why a lot of these tools that you're discussing here are incredibly important, especially when it comes to customs officials, so the people that will be sifting through these enormous piles of fins and trying to find the endangered species within that pile. And a lot of the burden will fall on them, often in quite under-resourced countries.
Yeah, and you know what? It's a really interesting time to discuss that, because that site, the requiem shark listing, as you said, contained a lot of those species, and the requiem family itself is probably 50 to 60% of the shark fin trade. So if you look at before, you had a pile of shark fins, what was happening over the last decade since those first species were listed, and we went from about 10 to 15 to 25% of the fin trade regulated, traders are smart. What they would do is then hide the listed fins, like thresher fins or great hammerhead fins, at the bottom of a huge sack of fins that were mainly requiem shark, normally a mix of blue shark and then maybe grey reef and other coastal carcharhinids. And so they'd get through in most charts. You know, customs can't inspect everything. They're doing a proportion of it. And we were seeing that from the market samples done in places like Hong Kong, the global trade hub for shark fins. So we knew that was happening, and that's a lot of the raw information that fed into things like the requiem shark proposal of, like, that's too hard, really, because we developed tools working with leading experts on identification that allowed you to identify those fins if you could find them, but you had to sift through these big piles to find them, both genetic and visual identification tools. So especially the visual ones can be used in any capacity setting. But even like dedicated, cheaper to use genetic testing toolkits that could tell you which species it was from. Now, the situation is actually really different, which is why we've been updating these tools. With the requiem shark listing adopted, now that pile of shark fins is almost all listed. So really the point of identification is more important at the point of landing. So a lot of the guides are being retooled. So it's looking at how do you identify whole sharks, which actually is easier. So good news is that's where we need it, because that's the fisheries data that helps us inform better management of their populations or identify the species that now are in need of protection. So there's that side of it, but the fins are still there. You still have a big pile of fins. And you can use visual cues to identify a lot of the species that are traded. So there we have both visual and genetic tools that are easy to use and have run a load of trainings for governments. So via WCS and our partner groups, we've delivered those trainings in places like Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Tanzania, Mozambique, Guatemala, just in the last few months, and have a range of those going on around the world. And indeed trainings in the global trade hubs such as Hong Kong and Singapore, looking at how can you enforce that at the point where all the fins have gone into their first sort of processing point in East Asia, which obviously could get you even stronger compliance action because it's a whole range of countries sending fins there. So now it's looking at, you know, the fins are all CITES listed. It's, in some ways, it's easier post the Requiem chart listing in terms of identification there. You're not sifting through these huge piles. You're actually looking at it and being like, well, is there a CITES permit? If there's not, that's an illegal trade. Now you can follow up using those visual guides, genetics tools for, you know, court-based evidence. And the kind of fascinating thing here is, you know, an organization like WCS, we have a huge counter wildlife trafficking program around the world. Their priority issues have been things like big cats, ivory, rhino horn, parrots, other types of wildlife crime and international trade. And marine species hasn't really been on the agenda quite naturally because it just wasn't a priority. So what we're seeing already is huge overlaps between that work and what we're doing on what we've done on, you know, marine or shark and ray conservation. And that's a whole other world of drivers, of momentum, of funding, of things that can help us speed up the progress of conserving these species. So in listing these animals on CITES and getting that critical mass of the whole trade, it's very interesting now because it's exposing sharks and rays to a whole different kind of type of management. Because realistically, as we said, you know, if people are not going to be good immediately, a lot of this trade is going to be illegal moving forward, and those listings are now in force. So it's about getting customs officials to be aware of that with training materials, with support, so that they can actually look at those shipments and say, well, no permit, that's illegal, and flag that up and help with compliance in that way.
And it's a, because I imagine, because they had a year, right, after the vote was passed officially, and that year is up. So I guess we're in the first couple of months of that enforcement. Yeah, it's quite a, it's a very positive place to be in, and as you said, very interesting and quite exciting, if you can use that word, for international trade in shark products. But exciting in the way that something is actually happening and moving forwards.
And I think the key bit we talked about there was like compliance and customs level, and that's crucial. And that is, I mean, it's exciting, we have the tools. I think we're going to see that momentum, we're going to see it quickly. We shouldn't kid ourselves though, the other bit's going to take a decade, if not more. But a decade's fine if we get action soon. And the other bit being, how does that turn into less dead sharks? And I think that's the key priority. Is a lot of people who maybe would be cynical of international governance and process, which would include me on some issues, would be like, well, okay, yeah, some rules, great. But, you know, this is still going on, you know, bad stuff happens. People don't listen to these rules. Do the governments have the capacity to implement this? All of this is correct. And that's the sort of stuff we have to combat now, is where we work and where our partner groups work around the world. You know, for the US or the EU, great. I mean, it'll be challenging for them. They'll work it out. They already are. You know, the EU is changing the ways it manages some of its pelagic shark fisheries because of these CITES listings. Great, because those weren't sustainable before and they need to move towards it. US is changing some of the species it manages and how, and countries like the UK, US, Canada, and others have banned the trade in shark fins. Now, they still need to deal with management domestically, but they have the capacity to do that. But how do we help countries like Gabon, like Bangladesh, like Mozambique, like Guatemala, where we're working on these issues? And the answer is by, you know, supporting things across the board. So you've got those customs issues, but how do we work collecting that data on fisheries catch, especially in those artisanal fisheries, and working out, are there sharks and rays within that that should be protected? And now you have the driver of CITES saying, well, if you don't do that, you know, you're going to be non-compliant. They're going to be looking at it. But if you do that, how do you make sure that those species are released alive? And that depends on the gear type and the situation. And now that you have a lot of species that maybe can support fisheries that are CITES listed, some of these smaller bodied members of the Requiem shark family, how can you develop, you know, simple fisheries management tools that are cost effective, that will allow that sustainable fishery to continue? All of these measures can result in less dead sharks, but that's what we need to be focusing on now. And that's the bit that won't happen overnight.
Yes, exactly. That's kind of the next decade. But just as we were saying earlier, is that the progress that we've made, I think it's quite easy to get bogged down in what's going on in the world, and especially when we hear about how much sharks and rays have declined globally. But if we think about where we were even 10 years ago to where we are now, momentum is building, momentum is there, stuff is happening. And the next decade is sort of building on that progress, really. And sort of hopefully is just a onwards and upwards kind of trajectory with lots of challenges and lots of hard work along the way.
When I very first started working on this issue, and it's nearly 20 years ago, so I had more hair, I was thinner, I was younger, I had more enthusiasm for life. But I was given a case file as like a junior government official, so for UK government, and it said shark finning, and it had a few things in, and you know, the Shark Trust, the UK charity, had just been set up and had started to write to the government and said, this is something we should care about. I'm not really sure what. And if you looked at the global picture at that point, there weren't regional fisheries body prohibitions for sharks and rays. I think it was just a free-for-all. Even the most endangered species could be caught in any way any of those industrial fisheries wanted. Only those three iconic species were listed on CITES, and they're not really part of catch or trade. And even countries like the UK and others hadn't really done much domestically to manage any of its, you know, shark catch or fisheries, even for its critically endangered species. If you fast forward 20 years, most of the wealthier countries in the world have shark fin trade bans and good management for their endangered shark and ray species domestically, with more work to be done, but that's in place. Most of the world's regional fisheries bodies have prohibitions on the catch of the endangered and critically endangered species. And for the first time in places like the Atlantic, are setting catch limits for the more abundant species like blue sharks. Lots more to do to make those sustainable. And then you have CITES, where you've gone from basically nothing to the entire shark fin trade and 146 species from three listed. So we should be feeling incredibly positive about the momentum base we have for shark and ray conservation. Now we've got to do the hard bits, but that's fine. But this stuff before wasn't easy either. And you have to walk before you can run, right? So this stuff is a great base. I sometimes think of it as that's all shark conservation 1.0. That's all the basic structure that you would need in place. And that's what happened for, you know, let's say cetacean conservation back in the day, or even for sea turtles. You had all these rules set up internationally, you know, prohibitions on catch, prohibition on retention. But then you're entering a new decade. And we're now seeing great whale and sea turtle populations in some situations start to stabilize and increase. So we can do this even for biologically conservative animals. So I'm hoping we've got through shark conservation 1.0, all the rules, all the gubbins all set up. Shark conservation 2.0 is things like, how do we make that work in lower capacity situations? How do we develop MPAs, like marine protected areas, that have shark-specific measures and actually reduce mortality? And how do we make sure that every country that's catching and trading sharks and rays has protective policies for the most endangered species and catch limits for others? So it's almost the, and I hesitate to say this, fun bit of there's a lot that can be done. And I think there's a lot that will be done. And the job for me and others is, how do we work to shape that to make sure it's based on the best science, that it's effective, that it actually reduces mortality, and that we keep people interested in it, whether those are scientists or funders or government officials. We can't lose that momentum now. We need to really drive that through.
I just have two final questions. One's a very short one. This one is maybe not so short. As we said at the beginning, you have 20 years of experience in marine conservation policy development and working in government and working with these kind of high-level strategies. And you have a lot of expertise in the conservation and management of sharks, as we've talked about in this episode. What is one thing that you have learned along the way that you would like to share with our listeners?
It's a good question. So I think the one thing I've learned is, if you're really driven and you really care about an issue, never underestimate the sort of impact you can have on it. If you care about marine conservation issues, there are now this wide range of opportunities open to you. I mean, if you go back two decades, really, your best shot was maybe being a professor, right? You might, you know, go and do your PhD, continue through that. Now you've got a huge range of opportunities within, you know, NGOs or charities doing all of this work. You've got governments who will have big portfolios of marine conservation work, and all of this momentum, not just on sharks, but on wider marine conservation issues. It's a field where we need lots of passionate, smart people working on this in the coming decades to do it. And sort of what I've learned over that time is, you know, I didn't study a PhD. I didn't go in and do that level of academic detail. That sort of wasn't the pathway for me. But I did find that through working really hard and working out what skills I have to bring to the table, there are ways to really impact and change the world for the better for these issues. And it needs all different sorts of brains working together to make that happen. So it really is. If you care about these issues, there'll be an opportunity for you if you're going to work hard and apply yourself to it. So I think, yeah, it's an exciting time. And if you care about marine conservation issues, you know, now's the time. In the coming decades, we're going to need all the help we can get.
I'm really glad that you said that, just because we do get a lot of people who email into the podcast. We get students, but we also get people at later stages in their life as well who have maybe gone down one career path and are maybe deciding that they want to go into something else, but worrying that they now don't have the expertise, or, you know, they're having to start from zero. And just as you said, all skills are valuable and applicable here. Like, we definitely need more economists, for example, yes. More business people, you know, a lot of different skill sets. So I'm very glad that you highlighted that. And my final question is one that we end every single podcast with, and it probably is my favorite question of all time, because everyone's got very different reasons behind which one they would be. But if you could be any species of shark, ray, skate, or chimera, because we don't want to discriminate our shark and ray relatives there, what would you be and why? And I have to put a little caveat in sometimes, because people get very hung up on maybe want to be that species, but oh, it's very overexploited. This is in an ideal world where everything is lovely and sharks and rays are in abounds.
I think it depends on what day of the week it is and what I'm feeling like, to be honest. I mean, like, who wouldn't want to be a thresher shark? It's like the Indiana Jones of the ocean, right? You got a big whip, you crack it, you catch fish, easy, you're cool in the high seas, you look awesome, divers want to come see you. So that, you know, that's, I mean, like, one half of my personality. Other half would say, like, a wobbegong shark is perfect. You just go and wedge yourself in a crevice in the coral reef, wait for food to come to you, just chill the hell out. So, I mean, yeah, so it depends. I mean, either sounds great, though.
But wobbegongs are amazing, though. And they, you know, they're quite sneaky.
They can move
fast if they want to.
I mean, at the New York Aquarium that WCS runs, they have a load of wobbegong sharks now. So that's my favorite part of visiting our office there, is getting to see them. So, yeah, and I think they'd probably sneak it as my favorite shark as well.
Yeah. Oh, they're very, very cool. We need to do an episode on just wobbegongs, I think. I have to put that into the episode plan. But anyway, I have kept you for long enough, and you've been so generous with your time. So thank you so much for answering all of my questions about CITES, about high-level policies, about all of this, you know, quite complex and very challenging stuff, but in such a positive way. We really appreciate you coming on the podcast, and it's been such a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on, and it's been great.
This podcast was brought to you by the Save Our Seas Foundation. It was hosted and edited by me, Isla Hodgson. Our beautiful visuals are by Jamie Silva. Our lovely logo is by Nicola Poulos. And the wonderful jingle you can hear right now is by David Knight. Again, an enormous thank you to Luke for taking the time to come onto our podcast and walk us through everything to do with CITES and international treaties and international policy. We so appreciate his time and his knowledge. And if you would like to learn more about Luke and his work with the WCS, as always, we will leave links in the show notes as to how you can do that. Please do go and check out their work. And thank you at home for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to rate and review our podcast. It really does mean a lot to us, and it helps more people to find us and find out about how amazing sharks are, and who doesn't want that? We also love hearing from you. So if you'd like to get in touch, if you want a question addressed on the podcast, you want a topic covered, or you just want to say hi, you can do that by emailing Isla at saveourseas.com, or by finding us on social media. We are at Save Our Seas Foundation on Instagram and at Save Our Seas on Twitter. Alrighty, have a jawsome week and we will see you next time.